It's Thursday, July 30th, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on health and diet in relation to Hermetic magic. And we will discuss various aspects of health and diet, including supplements, vitamins, so-called superfoods, and various diet regimes. Also, various therapies, exercises, colonics, the five rites, and energized water, advantages of the vegan regime and problems, and the great grain conspiracy and genetically altered food. And so, if you want to go on the wizard's diet, tune in and find out how to lose 20 pounds of ugly ectoplasm. Ooh, boy. Yeah, I just watched Ghostbusters the other night, you know, and we're gonna teach you how to get rid of all of that evil slime. Anyway, this is a subject near and dear to my heart, and that is actually closer than just a metaphor or a figure of speech, because I'm gonna relate some personal stories tonight, some of my personal experiences, and as kind of teaching points in the course of this discussion, and perhaps Frater Solomon will call in tonight. I invited him to, but we'll see if he does or not. Anyway, let's start off here I'll tell you some of my problems that I've had for years and what I've how I've handled it. Now, I was a fat, sickly kid, a fat, sickly kid with asthma and several other little kid problems that I mostly outgrew. In fact, I actually did outgrow the asthma, which was rather fortunate. But as I progressed from childhood to adolescence, I became more concerned with being athletic and what have you. And my father was one of these guys that lettered in everything in college, and naturally he kind of pushed me to go out for the football team and one thing or another. Football was never really my thing. I went out for it, but it wasn't really my thing. When I was a teenager, I became a spearfisher, and that was just right next door for me, because I grew up in St. Petersburg, Florida, which was on the Gulf of Mexico, and we had a lot of water and a lot of kind of neat bridges that you could swim under, and lots of very interesting fish that we learned to kill and eat. And I always tried to eat everything I killed, which was, I guess, commendable. But so I really got to be pretty good at it. And those were the days before the Aqualung, before we had self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. And so, I ended up holding my breath, for a couple of minutes underwater, which you kind of had to do if you were going to actually be successful at doing that. And I finally grew up in the whole thing, and the point where when I was in high school, I was going down to the Florida Keys and going out on the reef and shooting barracuda and tangling with moray eels and even having a few adventures with sharks and one thing or another, and you know, getting pretty good at what I was doing. So then of course when I finally got into college, that's when the Aqualungs came out, and so I went from being a free diver to being a scuba diver. And so that was what I did primarily to keep myself in shape. Obviously I had legs like a couple of tree trunks result of pushing those big duck foot fins. But I had a good exercise regime. I did a lot of swimming and ate a lot of fish and then of course after college I got in the Army and as I have mentioned before, I wanted something challenging, and so I asked them for something challenging, and they gave me Special Forces, and at that time you could enlist directly for it for a short period of time, which I was fortunate. And so I ended up being a paratrooper and going up to Fort Bragg and having doing a lot of mountain climbing and training and all that sort of thing that goes into that. And so I managed all through my youth to keep myself in pretty good shape. However, that all sounds great, and that was good for you. And I think one of the things that we need to mention in magic, and this especially applies to magic, is the old Greek idea that whatever you do for the mind, do you also for the body, because your physical condition has a lot to do with how well your mind works. And, of course, it also has a lot to do with how with your creative abilities and your original thinking and whatever. So you need to be in good physical condition, I believe, to be an effective magician. And of course, I think that most everybody would agree on that. And also, too, as a result of my Army work, I got interested in martial arts, and so I have off and on through my life. I've been involved in various martial arts, like a little bit of kung fu and a little bit of karate and a little bit of and then finally settled on ninjutsu, which of course I finally managed to settle on that as the one that I put the most effort into. And I've noticed since then that a number of hermetic magicians the number of them that have been through one of the various Togakuri Ryu ninja schools is rather surprising. You find that this is an Oriental discipline that seems to appeal to Western magicians. It also appeals to Western Special Forces operators too. This, of course, goes along with something else we're going to talk about tonight, and that's yoga. Because actually, you could say that martial arts, especially ninjutsu, is a form of yoga. It actually is. And magic. Although most magic in the West does not concentrate on yoga, ROTA is probably an exception to that, and most of them don't. But curious thing about it is, Western magicians, if they don't actually use yoga in their own particular practice, they usually, most of them you'll find, have been involved at one time or another in some yoga school, whether it's Zen or Tantra or whatever. You'll find that they have a lot of energy. Now, of course, we've in the OTA we have our own yoga, which is based on Western capitalistic principles, but it's also owes a lot to Tibetan Tantra. And this, if you, you know, in order to get the most out of your yoga practice, magical or otherwise, you should be in good physical condition. We'll talk about a certain so-called Tibetan regime. Well, might as well mention it now. The five rites, or the five Tibetan rites, and they have been published ever since about back around 1910 when the book first came out. This little book about the five Tibetan rites, the five rituals, has gone through I don't know how many different publications. It's probably, you can probably get it online, but it's readily available. And even my friend Don Craig recommended it in his Modern Magic. And we've used that for years and years. We recommend it. It's a series they look kind of like calisthenics, what they really look the most like, these five rites, is a breakdown of the classical yoga sun salute. Now, the yoga sun salute, which you should do at a very basic minimum before you do a yoga, before you get into yoga, you get down, on your hands and knees, and do a kind of a push up, an arch your back. That's called a cobra, and then you extend your arms and legs, and do a sort of a sit up, and then you come up and you do an adoration to the sun and whatever. And so that by the time you get done with doing a sun salute, you have just about done all of the five rites, the five Tibetan rites. He breaks these whole stages down into different rites. One of them you whirl like a whirling dervish. You go around, 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 around. They claim that gets your chakras going. Now, how these things originated, supposedly this British colonel, whom has been called by various names, but Bradford seems to be the one that I recall from one of the early versions of the book, and which some people call these exercises the Bradfords, because supposedly Colonel Bradford brought them back from his sojourn up there on the frontier, up around Nepal, and he visited this lamasery and he learned these five rites, and so he was so impressed with how healthy the monks were that were doing these things and all, that he decided he was going to teach them to old British curmudgeons. And so he gathered together a bunch of old British curmudgeons, men and women, and he taught them how to do these. And supposedly, according to the story, they found that it rejuvenated them, and they, over a period of time, they felt like they were getting younger, more supple, and everything. And sure enough, you try them and you work with them, and you'll find that they actually are really, really do affect. Even they do get you in good shape. It takes about if you do a set every morning. One set of them, it'll take you about maybe 15 minutes to complete the whole bunch, and you do them once a day, and then do your yoga, and you'll find that this is very, very good. So I've done that for years. It's a little difficult for me. I have a martial arts injury in my shoulder, and so I have a frozen shoulder, and this has been a lot of trouble, and I don't want to have an operation. I had to have both my hips replaced, and a few years back, as a result of hitting the ground with 20 miles an hour with carrying too much equipment. And eventually my hips suffered later on, and I had to have them replaced. So I have a couple of steel hips, but I'm not going to do that with my shoulder. I'm just going to tough it out. So, were you on somebody on the phone? This shoulder of mine makes the Bradfords a little bit difficult, but you can still do it. And so if you have some kind of an injury, or if you're overweight, the Bradfords will be more difficult to do. the more you do them, the less overweight you will be, and the more supple you will become. And so do the best you can with it. If you want to get into the Bradfords, do the best you can with them. And like I said, they're called the Five Tibetan Rites. I think Inner Traditions is offering the latest published version, but I'm sure if you just Google the Five Tibetan Rites, it'll take you right to them. And I bet you can get them online. I imagine you can. One of the things that kind of cursed me from an early age was that I grew up in the South, and that's Georgia and Florida, all right? My mother came from a Pennsylvania Dutch family, and they loved, you know, this basically that German cooking, and fried potatoes and the sauerkraut's okay, but you know, you get one of her favorite things was fried potatoes in the morning with eggs. You know, that's wonderful. But I grew up in the South, and we had a couple of black ladies for cooks and what we, you know, and they helped raise the kids, and we refer to them as your mammy, you know, or whatever. And so, and so consequently, they ate a lot of soul food, oh boy. And I told one of my black friends one time, I said, soul food made me what I am today. But it almost killed me because I ended up, by the time I was going on 40, I ended up with an atrophied gallbladder that turned into solid rock as a result of all the bacon grease that my mother and my two mammies had, they honestly believed that bacon grease was God's gift to the cook. And in fact, when I left home one time, my mother gave me almost like she was giving me the Holy Grail. She gave me a number 10 can full of bacon grease. She said, you need this. Oh boy. Well, my gallbladder sure didn't need it. But I grew up on a diet that was very, very high in carbohydrates and saturated fat and all of the things that all of the health people tell you not to grow up on. And so, you know, I had the gallbladder out, and of course, that kind of helped me with magic because I was so sick with that gallbladder that I got deeply into self-hypnosis, and I think I've told that story before several times. But anyway, the whole business of all this high fat content, high carbohydrate food that I had been raised in Eaton. And of course, when I was diving and spearfishing and running around in the woods with the army and all of that, I could work all of that off. And you can work off, and I was a chain smoker too, and especially when I was a professional writer. And you know, you can work that off too. You can work off smoking. When you're a kid, especially a very active kid, very athletic, you could eat these big high carb, high fat meals, and you could smoke like a chimney, and your body will throw all that stuff off. And so I went from soul food to army food. Oh boy. And I gotta tell you, during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, whether you like him or not, he decided that we were going to have the finest mess and army mess in the world, and so he drafted the chief chef at the Waldorf Astoria in New York and said, "You write the army cookbook," and so he did. And oh boy, the army cookbook was really, really it was an awful lot like mom and mom's home cooking, and a lot of they did. It was really the food was when I was in the Army, and I was in the Army from 1957 to 1960, and you know, during what we called the Cold War, and boy, the food was really good, and there was plenty of it, and of course, but we worked hard, so you could work it off, and but the problem with that is that you develop eating habits. You develop this idea of, I'm going to clean my plate then, and you know, eat everything you put in front of it. Oh boy, this is good. And you get, and you overeat. Even if you don't need to, you overeat. You learn to overeat. You learn because you're going to go, when you start doing this, you're going to go out and climb a mountain, or go out and dive under a bridge or something like that. You're going to do something to work that energy off. And a lot of us have that problem. We develop working habits. We eat like farmhands, and the American diet is based upon what American farmers used to eat. That's what the American diet, the three meals a day that the Americans are used to eating, is based upon the early 1900s American farm menu. Now, okay, keep that in mind, because a lot of you who are listening to me tonight, that's how you eat, because that's how you were raised to eat, and that's how your country, this is what your country believes is the all-American diet. We start off with two eggs and toast and pancakes and grits and all in the morning, and then we have a great big... We have a hamburger and order French fries for lunch, and then we sit down to a steak and mashed potatoes for dinner. And the problem is, we no longer in this country, and we don't exercise the way we used to. We don't burn off the calories that we eat the way we used to, and we are. We're literally killing ourselves eating a diet that we don't need anymore, and that is not doing us any good at all. But this is our national diet. I mean, this is how we are. We're still a nation of farmhands, even though we aren't working the farm. Most of us aren't, and we have to get ourselves aware of that. In fact, one of the things that I want to point out is that when you finally get yourself straightened out eating the right stuff, and you can eat the right stuff and without eating the wrong stuff, and you can still eat. In fact, Zandri and I tonight went to our favorite veggie restaurant, vegan restaurant, and we had what was close to an old traditional American Sunday dinner, you know, chicken and potatoes and gravy and this was all vegan. There wasn't any meat in it at all, and it was very satisfying. So you can still eat like an American and not have some of the disadvantages. But what you have to do is you have to learn to eat less. Even if you're going vegan and you're eating ersatz meat and ersatz chicken and all that, you still should eat less. You don't need to stuff yourself like you were going to go out and work on the farm. Now, as far as the diets, I want a couple other things I want to discuss here. You know, to kind of stay with what we have here in the outline is when I finally started, after I had my gallbladder out, and I had that out and taken out in 60, 68, and I started recovery, I started getting very concerned about my health at that point. And that's about the time when a revolutionary book hit the public, and this book was called Life Extension, and it was by a husband and wife team, Dirk Pearson and his wife Sandy, and they had a whole great big book on primarily on the vitamin supplements that Americans ought to be eating in order to make sure that they did not have the various vitamin deficiencies that so many of us did have. Now, this book was revolutionary because the truth of the matter was, with this American diet that we were eating, this all-American diet that we were eating, sure, we were eating a lot of food, but we were, almost all of us were vitamin deficient in one way or another. And so Pearson and Shaw, they came out with this book, and it was a bestseller overnight. And people began to be concentrated on taking vitamins and supplements. This, by the way, this launched the vitamin and supplement industry, which is now a major industry. And, of course, the medical profession howled like a bunch of stuck pigs because they were already into their syndrome that we know they've been in for years and years and years about giving you a chemical. Whatever your problem was, they got a chemical they can give you that will somehow or other, that'll make the symptoms go away. It won't do a damn thing for the disease, but it will but it will suppress the symptoms. And the medical profession and what we call big pharma were already under, you know, that was already what they were starting to do. Eventually it got to be almost virtually everything they did. In fact, the psychiatrists, there's no such thing as a psychiatrist who puts you on a couch anymore. You just tell him what your problem is, and he gives you a pill. And the rest of the medical profession was getting the same way. Oh, your stomach hurts? Okay, I'll write you a prescription for three or four things. So when Pearson and Shaw came out with this book, whew, the AMA was furious, and pharma was, these vitamins, they don't work. Oh, you know, you get all the vitamins you need in the food. Just eat a balanced diet and all this kind of stuff. But Pearson and Shaw were right. They were right. And that's what launched the whole vitamin and supplement industry right there. And it's still going, and they're still right. And in fact, my doctor, who is a vegan and very much of a health food advocate, he doesn't have to write prescriptions for these supplements because they're not prescription, but he'll tell me what to get and like, for instance, these satins, you know, the satin. He said, no, don't worry about taking, a satin drug. Take red yeast pills, and they'll do it. And sure enough, he's right, they did. In fact, I just got back, I'll get into that in a minute or so. I was going to say that the red satin really does work, and we just proved it. Pearson and Shaw were absolutely right about the vitamins. And for those of you who are not sure, if you're not sure what vitamins you really need, let me suggest that go down to Trader Joe's, and they've got a couple of what they call Pantheon packs. They're little round cans full of envelopes full of vitamins. They got one for women and one for men, and depending upon now, and well, I don't know, they'll probably have one for the in-betweeners too pretty soon, but right now they've got one for One for I was going to say you could buy if you right now if you're transgender, I suppose you could buy two packs and then just mix them up and take one day and one day the other or whatever. But I shouldn't say that. That's politically incorrect. But get Pantheon packs if you're not sure. That's but DeAndre and I both like these Pantheon packs, and we're both of us are Pearson and Shaw people. We both started off with Pearson and Shaw's book some time back. One of the things with me that I got through the gallbladder thing, got that out, but then I had to start trying to fight this weight problem. Well, you know, there are essentially three body types, and some combination in between, but there are three body types. There are ectomorphs, endomorphs, and mesomorphs. Now, an ectomorph is one of these individuals, like Twiggy or, that are permanently skinny. They're born skinny, and they stay skinny all their lives, no matter what they eat. And they don't put on weight. Their metabolism is so fast that they're perpetually thin. And that's the ectomorph. And the mesomorph is kind of muscular and then they can, and that's what I am, is a mesomorph. They can put on weight, and they can put on too much weight. And this metabolism is slower than the ectomorph. And then there's the endomorph, and the endomorph is, could say they're a born couch potato, but that's kind of cruel. But they're genetically and physically they're just gonna kind of be pudgy. That's the way they are. They have the hardest way to go because regardless of whether you're born that way or not, and I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings, but you still, obesity is a national problem, and of course it's a national problem that goes back to our farmhand kind of menus that we all grew up on or that we still try to promote, and they do this with the junk food too. I mean, here's this beautiful supermodel, she's an ectomorph. And she's eating this gigantic cheeseburger, you know, she can hardly get her mouth around it. So even if you are an endomorph, you shouldn't be overweight. You should try to control your weight. You say, oh, well, it's genetic and I was born this way and that's the way I am. Well, okay, you're born that way, and that's the way you are, so deal with it. With me, I'm a mesomorph, and this means that I'm halfway between the two worlds. I put on weight, and the reason why I do is because of, you know, I'm used to eating those big home cooked or army meals, and that's what I'm kind of conditioned to do, and what my psychology kind of craves, you know. Oh boy, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? I had to do something. I was having especially after I had the gallbladder out, you know, and I had no gallbladder, and that's kind of hard to control your weight when you lose that. So, what was I going to do? Well, I discovered something, or it discovered me, that saved me for years and years, and that was the Atkins diet. Oh, boy. The Atkins diet. what they used to call the drinking man's diet. And what that amounted to is Atkins discovered, as a lot of people have known, that the main food that puts weight on you is carbohydrates. And that includes sugar and of course alcohol too, because alcohol turns into sugar real quick. So they called it the drinking man's diet because the idea was that if you were a drinker, you could still drink and still lose weight because if you just cut out the rest of the carbohydrates and you ate nothing but protein and maybe 20 grams of carbohydrate a day, you know, you could have one piece of toast in the morning, okay? And then have your cocktail and have your wine with dinner and your cocktail and all that, and eat a steak. And it didn't matter whether you ate the fat too, because according to Atkins' formula, fat didn't matter. It was just don't eat carbohydrates or any more than by gosh, it worked. But it worked only for me. It only worked as long as that metabolism. High functioning metabolism that I had when I was a kid, and when I was in the army and all of that, and doing a lot of exercise, I had that. I was running on that high metabolism all the way up to my late 40s. To get about 50, I still had that fast running metabolism, so I could do it. I could do the Atkins diet, and I could keep my weight down it really worked. But then I crossed the 50 line and it stopped working. Oh boy. That's when Atkins didn't work anymore. What am I going to do now? Oh boy. Well, that's when I started feeling the family curse. My mother had been diabetic. And her mother had been diabetic. And sure enough, I suddenly realized, and I had to sideswipe somebody out on the road to finally realize it, I was finally diabetic and overweight. Mm-hmm. Mostly overweight and diabetic. Still trying to do the Atkins diet, but of course the Atkins diet wasn't working. And so... What am I going to do? Well, you know, got to lose weight. The main thing with type 2 diabetes, and that's the diabetes where you don't have to take a shot, but you've got it, and you got all these bad symptoms that go along with it, and you got to get it under control. There is no way to cure it, by the way. You cannot cure it. This is the idea that, once you get it under control, then you can go back and you can eat anything you want. That is a myth. And I mean to tell you that, Samir. You step back over that weight line, you start gaining, you get over your ideal weight, and it'll come back on you. And just as sure, so there are several myths about type 2 diabetes, and one of them is that once you get rid of it, it's gone. That's not true. Now, so what do they do? I went on Metafast. Oh, God. Metafast. Powdered food. I think that stuff was left over from World War II because they had this idea that they could feed these troops out in the Pacific on powdered food. And so the Army commissioned a whole bunch of, I guess the Marines got into it too, they commissioned a whole bunch of food companies to process this powdered food. Oh, God, it was awful. And so I went on Metafast, but it did work. I got the weight off, and I got back down to where I was technically no longer diabetic. And then when that happened, I bought back into the myth. Oh, well, I cured my diabetes. Now I can eat anything I want. Oh, no. And I very quickly found out that that's the, you know, very, and frankly, it almost killed me. And I had, and here I was, so I had to go and find another way. And I had a full body scan, and I was, and the doctor who gave me the full body scan read me the riot act and told me if I didn't do something, I wasn't going to make it and whatever. And so I went vegan. And I went vegan. And I, at the same time as I went vegan, I went on certain other regimes that helped, like the Dolly Parton stew. And I've shared that recipe with several people. The Dolly Parton stew. And what this is you can live on this stuff. You can't actually live on it completely, but it sure helps. You get a big crock pot and chop up a cabbage head, and chop up about four tomatoes, and chop up a bunch of green and yellow peppers, and then chop up a couple of onions, and then a bunch of garlic cloves, and then a bunch of broccoli, and some cauliflower, and throw in a few Brussels sprouts, and then pour in a couple of quarts of vegetable broth. And let it simmer all day and most of the night, and then you got this you got about a gallon of this stuff, which will last you for about a week, and my gosh, that really helps, because it doesn't put weight on you, and yet it will kind of fill you up, and if you season it correctly, put curry in with bay leaves and oregano, get kind of creative. It tastes pretty good, and you can add vegetables. You know, add other vegetables to it, like bean salad and garbanzo beans and things like that, to make it a little bit taste better. So there's that. There's that. And supposedly this is credited to Dolly Parton, although she claims she never used it. Somebody else credited it to her. It doesn't particularly transfer the weight to your chest, if you're worried about that. It doesn't seem to do that, but it does. It does kind of cut down on the belly fat. So there's that. And the vegan. Now I want to point something else out to you on this vegan stuff. There are several very, very, very tasty and enjoyable meat substitutes. And some of them have soy in them. And you want to avoid soy if you can. If you're going to go on this thing, soy is something you need to avoid. But there's an outfit over in El Segundo. They were on 60 Minutes a year and a half ago, and they've developed something they call Beyond Beef, and that's the name of the company, Beyond Beef. And you can get their product at Whole Foods. And they make hamburgers, and they make with sliders hamburgers and bags of ground Beyond Beef. And this is wonderful stuff. You can make a hamburger helper with it. I did use quinoa pasta, quinoa pasta, excuse me. I learned how to pronounce that stuff. Use quinoa flour pasta and make hamburger helper with Beyond Beef, and oh boy, that's good. And so you can actually get by with these substitutes for the sort of beef that you really think you need and all that. While we're at that, I'll talk about the great wheat or grain conspiracy. Now, a fellow by the name of David Williams wrote a book about lose the wheat and lose the belly fat, give up wheat and lose your belly fat. And essentially what Williams was kind of trying to get to is that he thought that more Americans than just 1 in 7 were sensitive to gluten. Well, this is not true. Only about 1 in 7 Americans is actually sensitive to gluten. So he thought if you cut out wheat, and wheat is very heavy with gluten, if you cut out wheat and don't eat wheat, then automatically the fat will just peel away. Well, if you're gluten sensitive, yeah, he's right. It will. But he thought it would work across the board. So I tried that and went on the non gluten. There are a lot of non gluten breads available. But then Williams went further and came out with another book. He said, It's not just wheat and gluten, it's all grains. You got to give up all grains. Well, this goes along with something that I had thought about years ago. I got this vision that refugees from Atlantis conquered the world with bread and beer. I became convinced of this. I think I channeled it or something, No, I don't get Ramtha or whatever, but one of my Atlantean previous incarnations whispered at my ear, we conquered the world with bread and beer. Well, in a sense, that is almost true, because bread and beer are the food of the slaves. And the Anunnaki, had the Anunnaki and the Ajiji in ancient Sumeria, they kept the people under control with bread and beer. Nobody knows which one came first, whether the beer came first or the bread came first. We don't know, but both of them, both bread and beer, will get you into an altered state. And that altered state makes you a good worker, good slave. Yeah, and get out there and dig the irrigation ditch and grow more. Yeah. And so when Williams came up with this grain thing, I said, okay, that sounds right. And I remember my vision and about bread and beer. And so, and by the way, another Atlantean thing that I go along with, modifying my vegan diet. I eat wild-caught salmon. We ate a lot of wild-caught salmon in Atlantis. That's why they call salmon the food of the wise. And not that we were that wise, but I mean, that salmon run was what fed Atlantis. So I eat wild-caught salmon, and that's good for the heart and good for the... And I also eat eggs from free-range chickens. That's very clean protein. And so that gives me enough animal protein in my vegan diet. That gives me enough to where I really don't need to take vitamin B12 under my tongue every night, which otherwise you have to. If you're going to go on a vegan diet, you are going to have to supplement that diet with liquid vitamin B12. You have to, because the only place that B12 comes from otherwise is animal protein. And back when I was in anthropology, we wondered why chimpanzees, who are otherwise vegetarians, why they tear a baby baboon apart every couple of months and eat the baby baboon, and they do it to get their vitamin B12. They have to. They got to have that animal protein. So you got to, if you're going to go straight vegan, you better lay in a supply of liquid vitamin B12. And hold it under your tongue for 30 seconds. Now, back to the grain conspiracy. I determined back when I was doing the Atkins diet and even but carbohydrates really were just really really if I slipped and got off and just a couple of hamburger buns would be enough to do it. And boy, that weight, the little fat cells would just poof right up back up again. So I became convinced that carbohydrates were poison for me. So therefore, when Williams comes out with this book on give up all the grains, you're not designed to eat grass. Human beings are not designed to eat grass. Cows are designed to eat grass, not us. You don't have five stomachs. So I've been going along with it. And I discovered another resource over in Julian. It was a little town in Southern California, a little mining town like Silverado, except it's more of a touristy. It's in the Cleveland National Forest too. A little town called Julian. They have wonderful apple pie, and they have the Julian Bakery. Maybe under the influence of the Lemurian Fellowship, I don't know, but they make something called paleo bread, which is bread made with almond and coconut flour, and it's non-grain, and it's like quinoa. It's nutty, and it doesn't have any grain. So I'm supplementing my bread with my carbohydrate bread now with paleo bread. They do ship if you want to order it from them. It's called Paleo Bread, Julian Bakery. But the problem with it is it's kind of moist. It's sort of cakey, sort of like banana bread. You gotta keep it in the refrigerator. So yeah, to make it bread-like, you have to dry it out in the microwave or in the toaster oven, and that's a little bit of a hassle. But if you agree with me and you think that the grains are slave food and you want to eat the royal diet, okay, then you might want to order some paleo bread. I'm not recommending it necessarily, but it's there if you want to. We mentioned energized water. Ah, well, that was a fad for a while, and I'm not sure that it's particularly good one way or the other. We got some nice magical rocks from Russia that I put in the bottom of my Brita cooler, and I think that kind of juices up the water a little bit, along with the Brita filter. We also mentioned genetically altered food. Now, let me talk about that a little bit. Not just genetically altered food, but humanly altered food. For instance, why do we say eat wild-caught salmon? Okay. Eat wild-caught salmon because farmed salmon, you know, they have salmon farms. They're like big rice paddies, you know, full of salmon. The low pools full of salmon. They feed them chicken manure. And they feed them chicken manure to such a degree that the salmon, when you cut a farmed salmon open, his flesh is gray. They have to dye it pink to make you think it's real salmon. Of course, it isn't, because you're eating a salmon that's been fed on chicken manure. So get wild-caught salmon, and it's got to say wild-caught on the label, and then that's real salmon. That's the food of the wise, okay? And as far as the free-range eggs, you don't want eggs laid by a chicken. Because you don't know, in these chicken farms, they just have these hens, you know, in a little bitty cubicle, you know, hardly room to turn around, and they feed, and you don't even want to know what they feed those hens. And that comes through the egg. Now, there's that. That's bad enough. Now, what about genetically altered food? Williams was right about not just the gluten with the wheat. American wheat is not fit to eat. American bread turns to sugar in your mouth as you eat it. Literally turns to sugar in your mouth. Sugar is one of the worst poisons you can put in your body. And it's sugar kills people. I think sugar kills more people than nicotine ever did. And the government keeps trying to get it down, and you can't get away from it by, and Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi is not going to do it for you. But I tell you one thing you can do. The secret ingredient, and this is one of the things that makes Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi addictive, called L-phenylalanine. Now, if you look at every one of those cans or bottles of Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi, you will see down there a little word called phenotronics. That means that they have added L-phenylalanine to the Pepsi. Now, what is L-phenylalanine? It is brain food. It is a supplement that goes directly to your brain, and it's an upper, and it gives you the lift. It's an upper, and it's a stimulant, it's a brain stimulant, and it's good for you, and it's an amino acid. So, don't get yourself off of Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi. That, you know what Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi are good for? If you got a bunch of rusty bolts, rusty nuts and bolts lying around in your workshop, just pour Diet Pepsi into a cocktail glass and just put your bolts, put your rusty bolts in the Diet Coke or the Diet Pepsi, and then in a couple of days they'll be real nice and clean, and you spray them with a little WD-40 and they'll work just fine. So it's good for cleaning rusty nuts and bolts, but it's not good for you. And you can get your L-phenylalanine. Go down to the vitamin shop, get yourself a big bottle of L-phenylalanine tablets, and take one every morning. Okay, and that's genetically altered food. Oh God, I don't know how many of you remember the film The Mask of Fu Manchu. Boris Karloff played Fu Manchu. This was 1934. And at one place in the film, he is getting ready to create a Taoist Wu Master's magic brew to control the minds of his dacoits, his slave army. And he starts making this stuff in this beaker. And he puts snake venom in it, and scorpions and spiders and all of this stuff that he adds to this brew that he's going to give these people to control them. And, well, yeah, this old primitive Chinese magic, it was that way. They did. In fact, they still have, you know, the poor rhino. You've seen these pictures of these poor baby rhinos with their horns cut off. That's Chinese magic. They go over to Africa and poach rhino horns and leave the poor rhino, without his horn, because they use the grind rhino horns up, and that's an aphrodisiac. Oh boy, I don't know what it is. But that is what our dear food processing, that's what our companies that make for seeds and fertilizer, and all that's what they're doing. They're adding scorpion venom to corn and to wheat. Why? Well, because scorpions are resistant to pests, and so the pests don't bother the scorpions. And so, if you put scorpion DNA into the wheat, then the wheat will be pest resistant. We don't need to spray it with DDT. We can put the DDT right into it. Oh God. And this stuff is not good for you. And American wheat, as I said, American wheat is not fit to eat. Don't put any of it in your mouth. And there's all kinds of alternatives. Even if you don't buy into the no grain, there's still alternatives to American wheat. There are plenty of them. So that's one that's really got to go. And now I think we're just about out of time. And I hope that I have given you people some things to think about and some stuff to. One thing I would like to mention, and Zandria was looking around before the show, and she found an article that on a lot of the stuff we've been talking about tonight. And this is an article. It's called Rob's Magic Blog, and that's R-O-B, Rob's Magic, M-A-G-I-C-K, blog. And Rob is a magician, and he has a show, an article on his blog about exercise, diet, and magic, which I'd like you to read. Zandria found it, and I read it right before the show. And he says a lot of the stuff we have covered, but he's also giving you some, he's taking some shots at some magicians that we all know and love, like Dionne Fortune. You know, why is she saying that diet doesn't matter when she's obviously overweight? And talking about chain-smoking magicians. And,
of course, our dear old friend, and overweight magicians, and our dear old Uncle Franz Barden, you know. Chain smoker, weighed about 300 pounds, and died of a bacon sandwich that his wife smuggled into him while he was in jail. A bacon sandwich, that's what killed him. And, Rob doesn't mention him specifically, but he's obviously going in that direction. This is http://. RobJoeWordPress.com 12/0/12/01 exercise, diet, and magic. However, I think if you just Google Rob's Magic Blog, they'll probably get you there, and then find the article Exercise, Diet, and Magic. Read it. I think it's quite good, and we were impressed by it. Okay, next week, I'm reading Catlin Matthews' Sophia book, which came out quite some time back. This is a revised version. I'm reading through it. Got a lot of interesting stuff that relates to some of the things we're doing, but mainly from a feminist perspective. So we'll deal with that next week. And until then, good magic.